I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Technology that helps monitor health used to be limited to the doctor's office. Now it's moving into your home, and it could have big implications for aging in place. From smart toilets to floors that can sense a fall, we'll find out today how houses packed with sensors could be the next step toward longer, healthier lives. Then, the internet is something most people use every day, but we rarely think about its effect on the human psyche. That's the subject of the new film called Images, which we'll discuss as part of our preview of Fringe Fest KC. Later, Brian McTavish brings us the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Technology is changing the world, and here's the latest example of it. What if your house could keep you healthy? What if your home was like another medical device? We're talking about houses crammed with sensors that would know if you've fallen, if you're dehydrated, and if you've had a stroke. If an ambulance needed to be called, that would happen too, just like that. A University of Kansas professor has been working with upper-level students to build a prototype of what this house might look like and how it could be duplicated relatively inexpensively. His work takes advantage of the existence of Google Fiber. That professor joins us now. He's Joe Calistra. He's an associate professor of architecture. And Joe, thanks for driving over. So nice to have you here.
Thank you, Steve.
What are you trying to achieve here, Joe?
Well, for a few years now, since Google Fiber came online, Kansas City's been asking, what would you do if you had unlimited bandwidth? And that's really an applicable question for technology. But for architects and urban planners, what we're trying to think of is how would you organize cities differently and buildings differently around big data? So at the University of Kansas, we've got an initiative to start a Smart Cities Institute that looks at how the built environment might better leverage this data.
And you've drilled down, you're looking specifically at houses. How did you get started on that?
Yeah, so when you think of smart houses, you think of smartphones being able to turn on and off appliances and outlets. What we've been looking at is how health markers might be collected and then used for things like population health strategies and the low-hanging fruit of whether someone has fallen or not.
How did you get started on this? Where did the idea for all this come from?
Well, we got a small grant from the American Institute of Architects and Mozilla, and we put some really inexpensive accelerometers, about the size of a quarter, and only a few dollars, actually, into floors. And what we started doing was picking up gait analysis. So just the simple heel strike of your foot hitting the floor can be read, and then that data can be collected. And we're starting to work with doctors and scientists and geriatric pharmacists and figuring out what to do with that data next.
And doctors say, and tell me if I'm wrong here, Joe, that you can learn a lot based on someone's gait, someone walking across the floor. You can tell what kind of health they're in at the particular moment.
Yeah, so where we started with this is the accelerometers that we use were put on bridges to monitor structural stability. So they pick up really slight deflections in the steel. We started putting them on floors and started realizing in addition to the floor deflection, we could also pick up people's heel strike. So it became a really powerful tool of understanding whether someone has fallen, whether they've left the apartment, how many times they've gone to the bathroom. But as you drill down into the sensor capability, it's about 200 readings per second. And so we're trying to dial back how much data we actually need. But there's a lot of health indicators that you can get from gait analysis. One is hydrocephalus, which is a form of dementia, causes your gait to be wider. Diabetes, as you begin to lose the nerve endings from neuropathy, you start to, the ball of your foot starts to hit before your heel. And so as you look at these patterns over time, you can start to see trends and start to have warning signs for residents. Another big...
And that's amazing.
Yeah.
Just for the record, that's incredible.
Another big field we're looking at also is it's beginning to pick up tremor. So slight tremor that you wouldn't perceive when you can't see, that your doctor wouldn't be able to detect, it can start to predict Alzheimer's and Parkinson's also.
God, that's amazing. What excites you the most about what you're looking at here?
The interdisciplinarity of it is just amazing.
Meaning?
So one of the things we're looking at is a smart toilet that takes hydration readings
Now right? We're getting somewhere.
Yeah, okay. It's not sexy, but the hydration reading in the toilet could be coupled with data in an automated medicine dispenser to adjust diuretic on the fly and heart medication. So as an architect, I don't know anything about heart medication or diuretics, but getting the geriatric pharmacist together with a plumber and trying to figure out how to put a hydration reading toilet in a 2-hour rated demising wall in an apartment building is really kind of complicated and right what I think architects and planners should be doing right now.
So the potential here is simply enormous. I mean, we're talking about a new day in America in a sense.
It is exciting. One of the things we're looking at also is sleep sensors that can tell how restless your night has been, how well you rested, smart mirrors that can determine through facial recognition software, stroke events and eye tracking dysfunction, even lesions on the skin. We've got circadian correcting lighting that can help with alertness and even depression. And then with the gait analysis, all of that tied together creates an incredible opportunity for predictive algorithms to get a more holistic picture. So one of the things we've been talking about is population health. The idea is that if you knew someone only had, say, 4 hours of sleep 2 nights in a row, and their eye tracking was starting to be off, and they were starting to limp or have some kind of balance issue, they were dehydrated, and then you overlay that with environmental conditions, like it's 29 degrees outside or the humidity is high. Maybe it's the end of the month and seniors are starting to typically ration their meds or something.
Mm-hmm.
If you had these sensors deploy in a neighborhood of, say, 10,000, you could identify 0.5% of people that might have a 99% chance of falling the next day. That would be really powerful information to let the resident know or their children know or maybe the caregiver at the assisted living complex that, hey, just take a little bit of extra time with this person. They might need a ride to the grocery store, check in on them, things like that.
We're talking about how sensors might change the American home and actually turn the house into another medical device. Our guest is Joe Calistra. He's an associate professor of architecture over at KU. You know, one possibility, Joe, that you're talking about here is something called lifelong neighborhoods. What is that?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't think wellness can be achieved only through this technology. And in some ways, it's secondary. I think the primary component to wellness at all ages really is a lifelong neighborhood and one where social connectivity is possible. So what we've been looking at is how you would organize a city in such a way that you could thrive at all ages. So it has great parks, great schools, mass transit, access to low-income wage centers, and all the amenities you might need as a senior so that you have more connectivity and more friends and family getting together and checking in on one another. The remote monitoring gets a bad rap, I think, because you assume that someone's sort of being left and warehoused in senior housing. And that's not the goal of this at all.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, some folks might begin to look at what you're doing here and think to themselves, I don't want any sensors in my toilet bowl. I don't want people knowing information that's that personal. What about that aspect, the privacy aspect of all this? And what might happen, Joe, if this information falls into the wrong hands?
Sure, that's a great question. So, you know, obviously the way we imagine this being implemented is that you opt into a program where you can take care of your parents a little bit easier, or an assisted living complex might have this as a service. But the way we're imagining this is maybe even deployed in the construction process in prefabricated homes. And so it would be in the background. You may not even ever turn it on. But 10 years into living in a facility, you may have a fall or a hip replacement. Dementia may be coming on, and you may want to tap into some of these services. I think that we're all struggling with what you can do with data once it's de-identified also. Mm-hmm. And so there's increasing case law on what to do if it's for the betterment of the public. But at this point, we're really just looking at it as a volunteer basis, that you just want to keep closer tabs on your parents.
Healthy Homes is our topic. Our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's talk a little bit more about some of this technology, Joe, the technology that will monitor your footsteps across the room. How expensive is something like that?
Well, what's exciting is that it's a fraction of the cost of a Fitbit or an Apple Watch.
So really?
A lot of the accelerometers in worn technology is already on the market. And so you can track your steps, log in online, and look at how you're doing. there's a big demographic, you know, 85-year-old seniors that aren't going to want to put on the Fitbit, that don't know how to log in and track their steps. So having this ability to work in the background is really an advantage, like I said. The other thing that we're trying to do is deploy it at scale. So we're looking at how to put it in prefabricated floor assembly units that would come to site for a construction project and in that way bring the cost down. So, you know, we're still working on how to commercialize this system, but it's probably a fraction of the cost of an Apple Watch.
I was going to say, though, if you do outfit a home, how much do you add to the cost of that home if someone wants to buy it and move in?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I think that to try to keep the price down below an Apple Watch or a Fitbit is critical. But the other thing that we've been looking at in terms of financing is the ability for senior housing and maybe even low-income housing projects to tap into programs where chronic care management voucher programs would begin to pay for some of this technology and also the upkeep and maintenance of it. In the American Healthcare Act, there was formerly a voucher that paid for these kind of things. Who knows where that funding will go now? But the idea is that if you're investing in preventative medicine, then it reduces drastically the cost of emergency care later.
Who would be around to monitor someone's footsteps trekking across the floor of a house? How would you even know would it just be monitored by a computer system that would then pinpoint if there's a problem somewhere?
That's a great question. So, for instance, as an architect, I don't really understand the data that I'm looking at. So what we're doing right now is trying to think of how would you graphically present this to a caregiver or a resident to let them know, you know, you're starting to favor your right side a little bit, or there may be something going on with your meds, or maybe something you ate didn't agree with you. What can we do, and who should this be sent to? Obviously, in a managed care facility like a senior housing project or assisted living, it would go to the caregivers. But I could also just imagine this being cloud-based, where you could log on to a website and see, has your elderly mother left the bedroom this morning, or have they gone to the bathroom and haven't come out in 4 hours, something like that.
What can something like smart mirrors tell you, Joe? Smart mirrors.
Well, the smart mirrors that are on the market right now, they have like a TV screen where you can sort of see the news and the weather. What we're looking at is facial recognition software that would not only track your pupils and your eye direction and responsiveness, but also lesions on the skin, moles, changes in moles and skin cancer. Even plaque on teeth, but probably the most effective thing we're looking at right now is facial recognition software that would detect slight asymmetries in the face that might be a warning of some kind of stroke event coming on or something that may have already happened.
You know, people listening to this, you're probably blowing a lot of minds here. I mean, this is really, voodoo stuff for some folks, but do you think this is where we're going?
Well, I think it would save incredible amounts of money in terms of healthcare. But there's also, you know, we're getting a lot of calls. Kansas City is an interesting place because we are seen as being thought leaders in big data and gigabit networks and smart cities. And so we're getting calls and interest from a lot of Asian countries that have a billion seniors that don't have enough caregivers. You know, the one-child policy in China has created a huge glut of seniors that don't have people to look in on them and take care of them. So there's an incredible market across the globe for remote monitoring.
I'm wondering, do you feel like you can work fast enough to provide the world what it's looking for right now?
Yeah, so I think what's going to drive gigabit networks in most cities is autonomous driving. Driverless cars are going to need that connectivity, and so we're just going to be sort of adding a little bit more data to that system.
In other words, a smart car then would know where to go to deliver a certain product if a senior needs it? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so, you know, the idea of driverless cars is that data gets sent from the car to the cloud, and it makes decisions about what streets to turn on, where other cars are in relation, and that takes an incredible amount of data. So to deploy those kind of systems that we all hear about every day coming online would require a huge amount of data being pushed and broadband capabilities. We're just hoping that those kind of capabilities are coming to almost every municipality and even across the globe.
Give us some context here, Joe. How far along in the process are you of actually developing these systems and then seeing them commercialized and actually deployed? I mean, are you years away from that happening? Are you just at the beginning of this process, or where are we here?
I think we're probably years. We're having some extremely exciting conversations with some brilliant scientists at the University of Kansas Medical Center and some other institutions across the country that are just starting to put all of these things together, understanding how you would analyze gait through predictive algorithms if you had not only months of data, but if you had data on an entire building or an entire community. So what we do right now is we do gait analysis, usually in a human performance lab, to see how someone's running or walking, what their reaction time might be. The idea here is if you had these sensors in a senior housing project or several senior housing projects or even multifamily housing, you could begin to identify neighborhoods that are not walkable. You might be able to look at why diabetes is prevalent in another neighborhood because there's no fresh grocery stores or there's no access to mass transit. So the implications of how you plan the city are another exciting trajectory of the research that we're starting to look at.
You know, your objective was to get a prototype done by when the school year ended in May, working with your students. And I'm wondering, did you get there?
Yes. Yeah. We
barely.
we built a small mock-up in our warehouse, and we displayed it at the KC Maker Faire last month, and it got a lot of great feedback.
I was going to say, what was the reaction?
Yeah, well, a lot of people want to put it in their apartments for their parents right now.
Really?
Yeah. And so the low-hanging fruit of sort of determining whether someone has fallen or not is really pretty powerful. But like I said, we had a number of people stop by the booth from Asian countries looking at how this might be deployed at scale to help the kind of density that they're dealing with at a much bigger scale than Kansas City or really anywhere in the U.S. is trying to.
Yeah, I'm wondering about your students working on a project like this. I mean, the implications of their work are very readily apparent, and that must be a really exciting thing for them to be working on something as cutting edge and as potentially rewarding as what you're trying to do here.
I hope so. I mean, senior housing isn't sexy. Getting the students excited about it is
But this all strikes me
tough.
As pretty sexy. This is pretty, amazing stuff.
The thing that's exciting is when you you go through a few years of college and architecture school thinking about the framing of houses being, we call it rough framing, mm-hmm. when you're banging hammers and nails. And very soon we start putting together wall assemblies with robots and framing tables that are automated and computer generated. And so thinking about rough framing being as precise as a medical device is exciting.
What happens now?
Well, right now what we're doing is we're going to have a big workshop in the fall to deal with the gait and the data and try to understand what are the different conditions we can draw from this data and how we would show it graphically so that a caregiver or a resident would know what to do with it.
I'm guessing that professors and students at other universities are working on similar projects, or am I wrong?
Yes and no. I mean, a lot of people are working on prefabricated housing, affordable housing, mass housing, housing for seniors. We happen to have this really unique situation with our Institute for Smart Cities that we have access to a gigabit network in Kansas City and all the expertise that has been developed around that over the last 5 years or so. So we feel like we're in a unique position to be leaders in this.
I was going to say, for a lot of folks, the advantages of Google Fiber have been a little bit lost on people, but you're saying here's a clear-cut definition of what one of the advantages has been.
Exactly, and it addresses the digital divide also. The advantages of this are probably most apparent and most potent for our most vulnerable demographics. So the poor elderly will benefit the most from this kind of data collection.
Maybe just a final point, Joe. To what extent are the possibilities here for smart houses of the future still unknown to us or not even realized yet? Are we on the front end of a frontier here, if you will?
Well, I think anytime you're dealing with predictive algorithms, you don't really know what it's going to turn up. So one of the things we're just looking at now is seeing patterns that we had never imagined. So people falling more at the end of the month has been, attributed to everything from full moons to rationing their meds. And as we
That's
start to look at these more, it's interesting how you can
That's
start
interesting.
To, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Joe Calistra is an associate professor of architecture over at the University of Kansas. Joe, thanks for coming over. Good luck in your work in the future. Sounds like really important stuff.
Thanks very much.
Okay, time for a break here. When we come back, we'll talk to an actress of a new film showing at this week's KC Fringe Fest. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday we heard about your first job and learned how the mayor's office is helping area teens find theirs. We also met a Pembroke Hill senior whose project on suffragitsu won gold at the National History Day competition. You can find those conversations online at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow we learn about a 12-year-old's glitter-shooting prosthetic arm. She calls it Project Unicorn because why not? We also meet some curious anglers who catch catfish using only their hands. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, a new film showing this weekend and next at Fringe Fest KC deals with a subject we all might want to re-examine. That is, what's the real impact of the internet on our lives? The film from Denny Day is titled Images, and it's described as a provocative, eye-opening, experimental film. With us is the star of Images. That's Missy Fenewald. She's a graduate of the University of Missouri, Kansas City, which makes her a star in my book. And Missy, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. It's good to be here.
Am I right? This film examines what you might say is the unexamined story of our times, which is the impact of the internet and it's having on our lives. Am I seeing that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that's the crux of it.
Why haven't we taken a harder look at this? What's your sense?
I think we're getting too caught up in it, where it's almost moving faster than we can keep up with it. In college, I wrote a paper about IM and if it was bad for the English language. And I found it really hard to find any information on it because it was just too new. It was still happening.
And we're so used to it. It's sort of everywhere anyway, so we don't think much about it anymore, you know. Why did you want to take part in this particular project?
Oh, just the idea of it, the experimental idea. He was telling me.
What does that mean, an experimental film? Because for some folks, red flags are going to pop up right away.
Yeah.
It's going to be strange. It's going to be weird.
That's not for me. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just something that it's a story that isn't heavy-handed, not spoon-fed to you, where you can kind of live in the idea of what we're presenting with you and not absolutely telling you a finite answer of what you should get from it. Mm-hmm. You know, that actually there's a little more leeway that you can put yourself into it.
Why is it okay in a movie? Because these days people want to eat their popcorn and drink their pop, and they want to be spoon-fed exactly what the resolution of the film is, you know, that kind of thing.
I think that's why we're doing this. The film itself is going to be a test for the audience to sit through and watch and try to process, and that's kind of a reason why we did it as well, just almost ironically to have people have their patience tested.
But it's not a complicated film.
No, it's actually quite simple.
Yes, very basic.
It's pretty much got three acts, we think of it, you know, where you kind of get to see the character, what she's going through. She's speaking to a therapist. You don't really need to know why, but you just start to understand kind of where she is mentally, you know, and then what we're really excited about is the color, the pace, the images, that you really just get caught up into it instead of being told what it is. And that's still powerful, we're finding.
So to the extent that you can, because I'm told I'm not to talk about the ending of the film or I'm going to die a slow, gruesome death. But tell us about the arc of the film and the plot line to the extent that there is one.
Absolutely, yeah. At the beginning, you start to get to know the character. Very bluntly, you're just kind of thrown into it. You live with that for a while, and then I think your brain kind of starts to sink in to the pace and kind of what this is, that it's not just going to be jumping everywhere and a whole bunch of things. You can actually just sit, relax, and just soak it up.
Mm-hmm.
Then it kind of moves into our second act, where you get to see that this woman actually has a ritual as far as entering a different reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she'll sit there.
That's how much the internet is affecting her and her life, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She has a disconnect from people where she actually just gets online. She looks at all these images. She connects with them. It's strange because then she even says, I can't move on until I know for sure how that person is. Like, it's almost like she's trying to learn emotions through her own, I don't don't know, just mm-hmm. own connection with what these images could be. Mm-hmm. Instead of being concerned with connecting with people outside, she's bringing it in her own safe way. Mm-hmm. But maybe towards by the end of the film, she's realizing that she's losing her grasp a little bit mm-hmm. through that. And yeah.
The bottom line, the impact of the internet on her life is profound, to say the least.
Absolutely. She doesn't go anywhere without her laptop. When she's with the therapist, she's staring at an image.
Not at the therapist. Nope. She's staring at the screen in front of her.
Never looks at him.
I was really struck by something else in the film, and that is that when this woman is walking around, in her world with her laptop, tell us where the laptop is held and maybe what that signifies.
Yeah, here. It's almost like her child. She's holding mm-hmm. it that close to her chest, that grasp. I mean, if you look, I don't know if you'll catch it, but my knuckles are almost white just because I can't fathom the idea of not having that with me to my heart almost. So you see her like walking all around to the therapist's office or just outside, and she's got it.
The question here is the impact on reality that the internet is having, mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you can't help but wonder how that's beginning to change, with the advent of virtual reality. We're only on the precipice mm-hmm. of profound changes that if you had to remake this movie in 4 or 5 years might make for an even different film altogether.
Absolutely. Yeah. When we were filming this and we watched it, we were kind of like, wow, this is a little more relevant than we realized was actually, when you're making it, you have all these ideas mm-hmm. and then it comes out. And I'm like, wow, that's incredibly relevant to right now. But we also were talking about, how relevant is it going to be in the now, like in the next year or two? What is going to be the other thing? Mm-hmm. This is very a general way of talking about it. How more, like, it's probably going to get more specific.
I was so struck by the whole premise of this film because we've done any number of shows here on Up to Date over the years talking about the internet and its impact and the impact of smartphones, everything from just spending so much time with them to the radiation they give off and all that stuff. And you're so right. We don't know the answers to these things. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing to me that we've gotten this far down the tracks here and we don't really know what the impact is for any of this. I look at my own kids sometimes and it worries me.
Yeah, I'm a new aunt. And so it's like I'm sitting here watching them and I wait tables. So I see kids, they're just like, here's the screen so I can eat my food. So I understand that to a certain degree, but like really, how do you measure that?
Yeah.
The impact versus, I don't know.
I mean, psychologists are now treating internet use as an addiction, mm-hmm. and some college-age young people are spending, four to 10 hours a day
looking
on the internet.
A day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm thinking about that, like, almost in my life, I'm like, oh, kind of guilting myself, like, I should have been more on Facebook telling people about this film, But that's really just not my style. I'm mm-hmm. quite private, and I don't really want to tell people if I'm drinking a Coca-Cola today.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to judge somebody if they do. It's just another way of connection. So it's interesting to know that for some people it works, some people it's not their thing, but ultimately it is having an impact.
I was going to say, since you've made this film, I imagine you've thought about the impact of the internet on your own life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
What have you concluded? Anything?
I've put my phone down quite a bit.
Have you really?
I really have. Yeah. Yeah. Because for me, I mean, it's becoming such a dependent source for many things, not just like social media. It's also how some people get their news, which is interesting, So I've just been trying to disconnect just a little bit as much as I possibly can as far as social media goes.
You would think the backlash against all this is just around the corner, that at some point people have got to start sort of coming together and saying, we're not going to be doing this as much as we're doing it.
I know, but it doesn't really seem like that's happening. It seems like it's just jetting forward still.
Yeah, not yet. Mm-hmm. Again, we're visiting with Missy Fenewald. She's a UMKC grad who stars in a new film. It's called Images. That's showing as part of Fringe Fest KC. All showings of the film will be at the Musical Theater Heritage Crown Center site on the third floor of Crown Center. And the Fringe Fest works this way. You buy a $5 button that serves as a cover charge for the entire festival. Then you pay $10 for each event you attend. The money goes to the artists and to the venue. More information about all of this and showtimes for Images are available at KC Fringe Fest. KCFringe.org. The other thing that struck me was just how alone you were the entire time in this film. You are a solitary figure making your way through the world with your laptop held close to yourself. which maybe is another way the internet is impacting us here.
Absolutely. Oh, gosh, what did we find out? That 3.5 billion people have access to the internet now. And I think it was in 95, 1% of the world had access to it.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of what you're talking about earlier, we just don't realize how fast it's accelerating and that it can have true impacts on people, including this woman, where you're with her at first and you're just kind of like, oh, she's sad. You know, I don't really connect with her yet. Maybe I'm trying to prescribe a blank emotion on her, sad, mm-hmm. angry, depressed. Okay, I'm not interested. Well, then as it progresses, you realize that, well, there's something to this person. She's really feeling something. She's not just one note. She's trying to process something that she doesn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And as the film goes on, you see her transformation to where at the beginning she's very tight. She's very uncomfortable. She doesn't know what words she's saying. She doesn't even know what she's trying to describe. And then later on, you see her have this transition. She opens up. But in this odd world where it's her own routine of escaping even further. So she's completely detached, completely scared, vulnerable with another person who's even supposed to be there to help her. And then when she's on her own, that's when she flourishes.
Hmm. What was the challenge, the particular challenge for you in this role and taking it on and trying to produce the kind of performance you wanted to produce here?
Whew. Oh, man, so many. It's a different film, you know, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, that first shot, it's just on me. The whole mm-hmm. time, very tight.
It's very tight.
Very tight.
Is that uncomfortable?
Denny is amazing. So no, he didn't have it completely in my face. I wasn't aware how tight. I just knew that I, you know, shouldn't move around a lot because I'm very physical person moving around. So it was when he gave me that direction, he just told me, you know, just sit there and don't say the next line until you completely feel it. Take your time. And we had like what ended up being 17 minutes worth of dialogue was almost 45 minutes to an hour of material he had to cut just because we took our time with it. And I really appreciated that direction. Also, it was challenging was trying to find a way to put on makeup for a half an hour because I don't wear that much makeup. So that was interesting during the routine.
Well, you sort of transform yourself mm-hmm. in this film through the use of makeup, which says something else, I think, about what the message is here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think what you get, especially when you watch or you see the different images, at first you think they're very random, but then you're starting, as the film goes on, you realize that there's a reason she's looking at these types of images and mm-hmm. that they're similar in a certain way. And what I take away from it is that she sees herself in those people. And so what she's trying to do is transform into those people to feel more in her own body.
To fill herself up mm-hmm. a little bit and fill the voids that are
That's why she goes
there.
Through that routine. You know, she puts this makeup on, and it's very similar makeup to these images you see, you mm-hmm. know, very put together, very, I don't know, traditionally pretty, I guess, you know. And then you transfer to the end where she's looking at the images. She can't look at those images until she looks a certain way, which is interesting.
Why do you think Denny Day picked Missy Fenewald for the star in this film, again, which is titled Images? Why you?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm super happy he did. This is my first film, you know.
Is that right?
It is, absolutely.
Were you nervous every day going on the set?
We shot it in 2 days.
So you didn't have time to get nervous?
No, yeah, we had like 6 hours. It was actually just ended up being much more... it was less stressful than I thought it would be. I had this, you know, idea like, oh my gosh, you know, this guy's trusting me with this. And then I get there and he's just such a calming force that we really are excited that we found each other to work with each other.
Was there a trial process you went through for this thing?
No, I had just wrapped up a show at the just off Broadway. And Warren Deckard there, he was doing a staged reading and we all enjoy working with each other, so he recommended me for this. Denny didn't even know who I was, and I read like 5 different characters, and at the end of it, he just came right up to me and said he wanted me to be in this film.
No kidding.
No kidding, yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah, I've done so many staged readings. So many staged readings. That's kind of my thing, I think. But yeah, some of them have come to other things, mostly more staged readings. But that's why I'm completely flattered and really feeling like things are going well just because, it kind of felt meant to be, I guess.
Why do you want to be an actress? What is it about this world that draws you so much?
It's honesty. It's connection. And it's an interesting time for the arts, I think, as far as that goes. Feels like people are in the arts for many different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been very fortunate throughout, you know, I'm not that young, but in the short time that I've been in it, to find my good group of people that do it for the same reasons. Mm-hmm. And then we're able to do our own shows. And then it gives me a lot of hope and mm-hmm. happiness and purpose.
Yeah. What do you think you offer the theater, you offer a film? What's the biggest thing you bring to the table?
You know, I'm told it's that honesty, vulnerability, that I really say it like it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that
you strike me that way just in the 15 minutes you've been here.
Thank you. Yeah. Where it's just like I'm more interested in the story. If somebody has written a story, it's their story. I want to tell it appropriately and with all my heart if I can. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? I don't want to get caught up in the, oh, if I turn my face this way, I look really good in the light. You know, I don't even know those things.
So when this film shows over the next few days at KC Fringe Fest, are you going to be sneaking in the back and just watching to see how people react?
Yes, I made that decision because
how could you not, right?
I know. I'm curious. And for me, it, like I said, there is a purpose to it. It does mean something to me. I want to see how people are affected by it because
mm-hmm.
it will test them. It will. And
yeah,
they'll get something different. Yeah.
Missy Fenewald is a star of Images as part of KC Fringe Fest. More information about the film, showtimes, kcfringe.org. It shows at the Musical Theater Heritage Theater up in Crown Center. Missy, good luck. So nice to have you here.
Thank
you all the best.
It was
okay?
a pleasure. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Missy Fenewald. Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Well, look who's in the house, KCUR contributor Brian McTavish, here to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend. How are you, buddy?
I am super good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be hot this weekend.
I had to change my shirt after getting in here from the parking lot.
Yeah, I get
I mean,
that.
It's really...
It's something extraordinary
something else.
Out there. Yeah.
It is. Well, speaking
this
of...
This is a picnic song.
Well, it's a picnic song. You can wear your picnic socks and sing this picnic song when you go to Kansas City.
I haven't heard this song in a long
big
time.
Picnic, yeah.
This takes me back a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, can you name that tune?
Well, Daniel Boone, Beautiful Sunday.
Was that his real name?
I don't know, but that's on my script
it
here,
had
so
to
that's
be.
Why I knew the answer to that question.
Why would a budding pop rock star long ago and far away call himself Daniel Boone?
I don't know.
Unless he was Daniel Boone.
I don't know
anyway,
why pop stars call themselves anything they call themselves.
To go pop, obviously.
Yeah.
Okay, it's art, it's music. Art. It's games, maybe even lawn darts, although that might be too dangerous. And it's food trucks at the Kansas City Big Picnic, the annual affair out at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, Donald J. Hall Sculpture Park, and then across Emmanuel Cleaver II Boulevard or what have you.
They're going to shut the street down? Or
they are going to shut part of the street down. It's from 4 to 8 Sunday is the actual event, but it goes all the way to Tice Park across the way from the southern lawn of the museum all the way as far as the eye can see.
Love that part of our town.
Oh, we love that part of our town. You know, way back in the hippy-dippy 60s, of course, the 60s didn't hit Kansas City until the 70s, so we'll say, you know. But back in the 70s, that's where all the long-haired people, the youngsters would go. And you'll get youngsters there, but I'm sure they'll be of varying descriptions. It'll be a big community love fest at the Kansas City Big Picnic, 4 to 8 Sunday. Go out to the Nelson, have yourself a good hot time.
Sounds like a really good time.
A really good time. Bring sunscreen, bring lots of water. And the food trucks are nice if you don't want to have to pack your own repast.
And of course you don't.
No, not really.
Let's talk about someone else who's going to be in town here, Steve Martin and Martin Short with the Steep Canyon Rangers. And Steve Martin's one of those guys I've always been, I think he's just an amazing guy.
Yeah, you don't have to excuse yourself for liking Steve Martin.
No.
They call it an evening you will forget for the rest of your lives.
Yeah, there
so
you go.
No matter how hard Steve Martin and Martin Short, who of course was a big star with SCTV.
SNL.
That's right. You know, purists just go back to SCTV. But then he did, I won't say slum on SNL, but he did a couple 3 years there. Anyway, 7:30 Friday night at Starlight Theater. You got Steve Martin and Martin Short. Martin Short will be very, 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 very funny. I dare say funnier than Steve Martin. He is a quipster deluxe. Mm. And these guys go at it, I'm told, for at least a half an hour solid, exchanging one-liners on stage. And then Steve Martin, who's quite the banjo player,
yes,
right?
Yes, he is.
He's going to show off his sizable chops with the bluegrass band, the Steep Canyon Rangers, who he regularly performs with. So I think there are still tickets left. The best part is they're the cheap seats in the back. They're not going to cost you a lot, and they're just as funny as funny in the back row. Funny too, if you'd like. 7:30 Friday, Starlight Theater. Let's listen to how these two guys met. Here are the two Martins talking about how they met on the set of Three Amigos.
I remember the first time I felt Marty was funny, and I kind of worried about him. I was on the It was the first day of shooting on the Three Amigos, and I was walking to the set, you know, the whole full outfit, and from behind me, I heard Katharine Hepburn say, "Where's my bicycle?" And, well, you do it better. Do what you did.
I said, "Where the hell? I wish I had my bicycle. We'd go and pick blueberries. Such a beautiful day."
It's pretty good. That's pretty good.
It's the tip of the punchline. These guys are going to slay you. Go collect some blueberries with Martin Short. He'll do Katharine Hepburn. He'll do whatever it takes to get you to guffaw Friday Night Starlight.
You know, Steve Martin's got this new thing online. Yeah. I just saw where he's teaching this online course and on his comedy thing, and it's, you know, a moneymaker for him. But I actually looked at it and thought, that would be interesting coming from him.
Did you sign up?
I did not. Of course not.
Why not?
But too much money.
Exactly.
But it's still interesting.
Well, it is funny how even
I watched him fill out, you know, he sold out arenas back in the 70s. Yeah. A single guy up on stage with an arrow through his head. And that worked for him to an amazing degree.
Well, and he can come at it from the perspective of somebody who just absolutely ruled the world doing arena comedy tours. And then he quit, did it for a couple of years, boom, no more, just movies after that.
Yeah.
Some years back, he came back to the stage, but under the auspices of the bluegrass personality that he likes to exude. So now he's teamed up with Martin Short. I just can't say enough about this. I'm actually, can you tell I'm visibly shaking?
Yes. Be sure to see Brian's six sassy things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. Well, the KC Fringe Fest this weekend is going to take it to the limit. We've been talking about it all weekend.
I'm proud of you. You've had on people, like, just a little while
interesting
ago.
Interesting people. Missy, she's great.
The talented young actress. It was very wonderful to hear on my drive-in. And earlier in the week, you've addressed the festival as well, the Fringers?
Yes, right. We did.
Now, there's over 90 shows. Opening weekend.
90.
Yeah, goes
90.
Throughout next week. So here's just a few, as time permits, I'd like to share at various venues in downtown and midtown KC. Okay, so whatever the number one event at this year's Fringe Fest turns out to be, I have definitely the number two event. It's called The Taming of the Pooh. It's got to be number two, right?
Yeah.
Now, this is what we do at the Fringe Fest. We take it to, or perhaps a little past the limit, what you get on Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 4:30 at the City Stage at Union Station downtown. Is sassy storyteller Bree Henderson and other talented local performers on stage exploring the real-life comedy, the true stories of absolutely factual poop tales. We've all had them. Are you excited?
No.
Are you ready to poop?
No.
Good. So, you've been warned.
Okay.
I've warned you. Now, moving on to something that might put a smile on your face, although trust me, listeners are smiling. We also have Breakneck Julius Caesar. That's the one-man performance of a Shakespearean tragedy. That's Friday and Sunday at the Unicorn Theater. There's also Shelter Shorts. That's a play about shelter pets and the people who love them. That should be nice, with an edge. It's an all-ages event that takes place at the Unicorn Theater this weekend. This sounds fun. From Alphabet Street to When Doves Cry, 99 haikus about Prince. 99, like 1999, get it?
Okay.
Anyway, there's a slew more.
Okay.
Go to fringefest.org and load up and have a good time. And you might want to, you know, I tell you what, that number two show, it might be calling your name. It might be.
Search the
Man, that's the Smithereens. Haven't heard them in a while.
Well, that's why I'm here, to play that stuff you haven't heard in a while, okay?
There's always an oldie but goodie.
When this oldie but goodie shows up,
McTee's,
that's
mailbag,
right. It's ho-ho, baby. I live for the past, and I look forward to the future, exploring the past with you. Okay, it's the Rock the 80s tour. Three big bands, at least they used to be. The Romantics, right? What I Like About You, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And then you have the Smithereens. This Is Only a Memory. They had A Girl Like You. And then you have Bow Wow Wow. Remember their big hit? They had a great album cover of a half-naked lady called I Want Candy. The show was at 8 o'clock Friday at Crossroads KC at Grinders. One little tidbit, I'm sure we have time for it. This tune we're listening to by the Smithereens, Only a Memory. I love this band for precisely the reason I'm about to expound. Not only did they love the Beatles, they knew how to give sideways salutes to true-believing fans. The opening guitar riff that we heard to this sounds strangely like, but not quite like, the opening guitar riff on the Beatles' I Want to Tell You from their Revolver album, 1966.
Where do you find these things?
From between my ears, and I bring them out through my mouth to you now.
And finally today.
Finally.
Here.
Okay, we got Gretchen Wilson.
Yeah.
Always loved her, always will. After a few years away from the spotlight, she had a daughter approaching adolescence in those all-important teen years and thought she'd take a break. She made her million or three, and
her
so she took a little break, but she's still that country gal who's here for the party. She has a new album, just came out this year. It's called Ready to Get Rowdy.
Huh.
Not a shocker.
She's ready to roll again.
Yeah, she's probably been practicing her ready to roll for quite some time. But you'll hear oldies but goodies from 10 or 12 years ago. Here for the party, politically incorrect, all jacked up, and lots of tracks from Ready to Get Rowdy, including this one called A Little Loretta. And that should go a long way tonight at 7. Free show at the Kansas City Live Block at KCPNL. Downtown, have a free, good swing and fun country time.
That's Brian McTavish with your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, my friend.
Tomorrow on the show, we meet a 12-year-old girl who's become an advocate for people with limb differences. Also, we find out why people would catch a catfish using only their hands. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.